Good evening. Welcome. And thank you for coming to the third installment of the River Styx at Duff's 35th season. Tonight we feature poets Sherwin Bitsui and Stephen D. Schroeder, both of whom have new books for sale at the River Styx table over yonder, where you'll also find the brand spanking new games issue of River Styx. It's still lukewarm off the press. This didn't really start out as an excuse for a basketball issue, and I know a lot of people know that we play basketball religiously, including Stephen D. Schroeder and the basketball posse who made it here for tonight's reading, for which we thank you all for coming. And there's more than basketball poems in here. We've got puzzles, we've got weird sex games, we've got all kinds of stuff in here. So I hope you get a chance to peruse the issue, because it's a good one. Also, we've got flyers for our Schlafly Microbrew Microfiction Contest, some back issues, and assorted River Styx stuff. So make yourselves at home at the River Styx table. Alrighty. One particularly astute critic blurbs on the back of this book, in Touched Verse Ends, Stephen D. Schroeder pulls poetry out of its two small boxes and scatters it all over the room. One poem imitates form, the next mocks mental health surveys, and the herky-jerky music mixes high diction and slang, pop culture and wordplay, solemn hymns to nature, and geeky robotic laws. Why deny lines like, "Nature is a MILF," or "Artificial plants inhaled oxygen, exhaled chlorofluorocarbons," or "Your lips could suck the gin from juniper"? Schroeder is a serious poet, whether the poem is sad, surreal, or just plain silly. Another perceptive critic, who, like the first, may also be in this room, blurbed, "The poem..." This is a really easy intro to write. "The poems in Touched Verse Ends reveal in the interconnections between humans and our place, real or imagined, in the world. So it is fitting that the poems shift locations with the personalities of the speaker. Some poems wisecrack their way through Matt Groening's Springfield. Others speak to us from robot land and the error of metallic vernacular. Still others employ more somber diction. Colorado is seen by forest firelight. The road somewhere in the flat between Colorado and Kansas. Regardless of place, Steve Schroeder's poems move us forward toward the hills and rivers where the earth's curve intensifies downhill." That being a quote from a line from a poem. "The poems keep us safe in their own geography." Stephen D. Schroeder's first full-length book of poetry, Touched Verse Ends, appeared from Blaze Vox Books in spring 2009. Scantily Clad Press published an e-chap book of his poetry, 90% of Nothing, in 2008, or 90% of Everything in 2008. His work has appeared in or is forthcoming from New England Review, Verse, The Journal, Beloit Poetry Journal, a whole bunch of other ones, including River Styx, the new issue, the Southeast Review, Cut Bank, 32 Poems. He edits the online journal Anti and works as a certified professional resume writer. Long a resident of Colorado, he now lives and plays basketball here in the Bevo area of St. Louis. Please welcome our good buddy, Stephen D. Schroeder.
Thank you for the introduction, Richard, and thank you for the blurb. And also thank you for being about the same height as me so I don't have to adjust the microphone. I could take quite a while doing that. I'd also like to thank everyone here for coming out tonight in this lovely, lovely weather. And thank you to Duff's for hosting us. And get drinks, tip your bartenders. I always like to start out my readings with something, an appropriate piece, and in this case that means a bar poem, which I have quite a few of. This one is actually more of a pool hall poem, but I think it's close enough. And this is also about as close as I get to being narrative or autobiographical. Just take that for what it's worth. It's called Cushion. To win, my brother needed to bank and sink the eight ball, a hateful trick of spin and divots, angle of incidence not equaling that of reflection off the cushion, stare focused down the shaft, hair strung out on rail felt. He said, "I forgot to tell you, Laura got an abortion." He'd also forgotten to tell me she was pregnant. I hit this, you get the next round. Backstroke unhindered by two empty pitchers, he rebounded his shot into the pocket's open mouth. I have quite a few poems about my brother, most of them not quite so direct as that one. I get along with him very well now, but when we were kids, we had sort of an ongoing war for about 10 years, including I'm 5 years older than he is, and my best friend and I sort of tormented him on a regular basis, and this poem came out of that many years later. It's called We Never Did Anything. We never did anything bad to him. He never did anything bad to us, he said. He cried. He lied. He hit the reset button. We hit the wall with him. We taught him to shout shit at the neighbors across the street. He learned his words with fucking Cocoa Puffs. He squeaked when squeezed. We named that disease for him. We slingshotted golf balls and ball bearings. He bundled up in blankets and blundered through the dark. We were a bear, hungry under the stairs. He hid the hummingbird feeder syrup. He pounced from the ceiling fan as it spun. We grabbed the scruff of his rubber chicken neck and shook. He stuffed himself with fluff and hot light bulbs. We wrapped him in subliminal tape while he slept. We unzipped his chest. He was completely whole. He never did anything bad. We never did anything worse. I was just talking to someone recently. I was saying, I feel like now that I'm 32 years old and I've been out of college for 10 years, I should really stop having the recurring stress dream where I'm back in college and I don't know my schedule or I'm not going to graduate or something along those lines. But it keeps coming back on a regular basis every few months, and I'm kind of sick of it. But I guess the other thing you should know for this poem is I was a quiz bowl player in college, which means I'm a big trivia nerd. And so a lot of the stuff in the middle is completely trivial facts that is not important at all to know. So if you don't understand them, you should be happy. And I get most of them wrong in the poem anyway. I deliberately get them wrong in the poem. It's called Commencement Address Penned on a Bar Napkin. Assemblage of loose limbs, besodden on alumni lawn, sprayed evergreen for your parents, in whose wake live oak leaves quake as irises plant in front. Your dream of the organic chemistry final administered by a monkey benzene ring will never drain, unlike a bottle of bourbon. Even if Java Man was a coffee-mad, knife-happy gibbon buried under floorboards, he graduated before some of your cousins. You, music major, to sing Handel's Surprise Symphony, surprise the hell out of Haydn in bed. Oh, this mid-May humidity, Mrs. Empedocles and his ability to assemble cumulonimbi. Drill Holbein through your skull, and you too can paint the pants on Henry VIII, I am, while he wrestles Francis on the gold of the field of cloth and names a blank framed paper after you. Rum comes from a great tumult and soon returns to one. I have wasted my education. As Richard mentioned in the intro, I lived in Colorado for about 20 years. I moved here 2.5 years ago. And so my first book has quite a few Colorado poems in it, and also sort of an obsession with wildfires. And I don't want to waste everybody's time with too much Colorado stuff here in Missouri, but I'm going to read a couple of Colorado poems. And they're both fire poems also. And the first one, the title completely sets it up. It's called Hayman Wildfire Set by Forest Service Worker. that you spotted the fire and the starter, that he drove a gold minivan, a smokescreen obvious as pyrocumulus covering Pike's Peak, that he lurched into yellow sky to escape, chased across four counties by those thousands of torches searching for a monster, that you, but not yourself, ignited the fire, that draught winds and updrafts could waft you away, spreading embers over river and highway, that hotshot crews with Pulaskis clearing fire breaks, sweat baked out, would clear your name among the mulch and soil, that a letter from your estranged ex lit the fire, that matchsticks and paper turned arson upside down here to build a fire, to build a pyre of human fuel, that the campfire ring of rocks fit for your finger crowned no trees and its dying to ash lasted less than 20 days, that a helicopter shuddering above forest stubble can feast on sides of beef lying barbecued near burned carcasses of barns, that replanted ponderosa pine seedlings can feed on satellite feeds for 20 years, that fire started you. And the second fire slash Colorado poem is a much more family-oriented one. I don't like to do long backstories, so here's the backstory for this one. My extended family had a cabin up in the Colorado Mountains, and that cabin burned down, and we rebuilt it. There you go. The story, or the poem, is called Phoenix, Colorado. The wood stove at the cabin's center, where every star collapses, stirs up its apparitions. Aspen gold leaf, mule deer beguiled by salt and song, camp robber courts for Stellar's jays grazing the rail in sunlit crowns. That creek becomes the Colorado. Earth's curve intensifies downhill beyond the glacial glass in frames of beetle-killed blue spruce. In folktales, some nests hold snakeling eggs, some cages don't hold, and some things never die, damn liars, but wink from grates and doors. A ring where trees retreated, beneath the gravel, char. Like stars, this family, one generation fuels the next. Pentatonic music, rocks forgotten on the mountainside. We reemerge and wait all night for sizzling rain on the steel roof, then rise in sun, no longer ashen. I'm going to change tones kind of abruptly. This poem is one that that you will have heard a line from. I'm reading it sort of for nostalgia when I read in the Hungry Young Poets series here right after I moved here over 2 years ago now. I think this was the first laugh I got when I read, and I always like that. You may know, it includes the acronym MILF, which is short for Mother I'd Like to Fuck. And the poem's called Bad Nature Lover. Nature is a MILF, overt estrus bent over a tree stump. Damn rabbits overpopulate. We need more control, less lagomorphing. So I glue hooves to lucky feet, rack antlers to make jackalopes, and graft fruit tree branches onto cottontails. Come harvest, I peel apples slowly, wholly, as if their pelts will fetch me $40 at Fort Bridger. Inside their skin is soft, white fur. Soon I will grab rab apple pie in bunny oven mitts. And this poem is... I don't know how many people here are video game players, but if you play any sort of online shooting game where you're shooting other players, this will probably seem fairly familiar to you. If not, it's going to seem quite violent and perverse. It's called Deathmatch Mode. First Ty killed Jay, killed Jack, killed Rick. Next, the dead three set a trap for Ty, caught her in crossfire, gunned her under. But Jay stabbed Jack in the back and scattered Rick with a missile. Then Jack forced Rick off the cliff, from which he dropped a rock on Jay and rained grenades on Ty. Rick popped back, beheaded Jack with a battle axe, and picked up the body to bludgeon Ty before he and Jay chainsawed each other, a bloody Ty. Everyone murders and rises and dies, and no one says or even knows what life is like after they lose. And this is the last poem I'm going to read from the book, and then I'll move on to a little bit of new material. This one is one I find myself reading quite a bit these days, and it seems appropriate since I guess we're starting to go into what they're calling a jobless recovery from the recession, which doesn't really seem like a great recovery, does it? It's called So You Want a Worker. You may only hire a worker if you promise to feed it and clean its messes. Please allow 2 to 4 weeks for delivery of your worker. Please allow your worker out of its metal crate twice a day for exercise. If you turn the heat up slowly, your worker will not attempt escape. You may only redeem your worker for store credit with a receipt. Your worker must be this tall to board the corporate jet. You may not carry your worker in your briefcase. Your worker will not attack itself in the mirror if you're watching. Do not bite your worker back. Wagers on your worker fighting are legal in international waters. Your worker is licensed for Florida and Indiana only. In India, your worker is a delicacy or sacred, maybe both. Your worker does not contain tasty candy bars for vending. The 10th time you use your worker, you earn a free drink. No, you may not buy another worker. You don't pay the one you have. Your worker will stare up at dropping stocks until it drowns. When your worker dies, bury it after you leave it in the freezer at least a year. Do not flush your worker. And set of new poems I'm reading is all from the same project. The only really relevant thing that you need to know is that all the titles are stolen from other sources, famous quotes and things, poets who I think are better than I am. And the first one is one that if you've seen me read around town in the past year or so, you've almost certainly seen me read this poem. This is one where I stole the title from our own Adrian Matika, and he hasn't seen me read it yet. And also, there are a lot of my basketball buddies here tonight, so I'm going to read my basketball poem. And like I said, the title stolen from Adrian, it's Can I Not Get a Run? Belly swollen from too many Racanelli's fill-ups. Skull tattoo on a shoulder scarred by rotator cuff surgery. Glasses perched, ready to fly. You think you got game? We named your game 76 Ways to Brick a Layup. 5 fingers jammed and jarred. 4 letters for broke down. Meet your 3 teammates, fathers of 2 score years. 1 wears clodhoppers and picks like a brick cistern. Can't shoot lights already out. You'll fit right in. 1st team to 50 points wins. 1st man to 50 may drop. The rim, a peach basket that dips in each airball breeze. Dust carpet on floorboards. Youth lost underneath. Top speed is slow motion, freeze-framed for every jumper. The clock never buzzes 0 or resets to 24. And I called that my basketball poem because that used to be what it was, the only basketball poem I'd ever written. I actually have 2 basketball poems now, so I'm going to read the second one. It's quite a bit different, actually. It could almost as easily be about NCAA football as about NCAA basketball. And the syntax in this one kind of twists around a little bit. I hope you can follow it. The title of this one is stolen from a Public Enemy song. It's Can It Be the Shoes? What's your name? Can you explain that answer is worth 200 on the exam? Is dome to shave as points are to have, if game is to ball, is to throw, should you know for who or whom the whistle blows, the stud in student? Vertical is to wingspan, as tutor is to what good comes from committed suicide, a felony, to an institution, or all of the above. If the governor bets your weight in cheddar spread, who's your highest paid state employee daddy in Armani makes how many men argue about is it army recruiting or the overdraft? How much do you owe for the offer you tossed your name into, what the I in team lost? For my day job, I write resumes, and I've always sort of tried to write a poem in the form of a resume, and that's never worked at all. The ones I've tried have been just awful. So this is as close as I've come to that. It's another sort of job poem, and at least it mentions resumes. It's called On Paper, I'm Not as Scared as I Seem. Geography of office wall seams defaced by box cutters. A box the size of Colorado locks inside a chest the size of mine. The data mines free of demons except excessive drinking. At lunch, I drink the ink from obsolescent resumes. Tuesday afternoon resumes its promise of return on churn. Interns restrain and retrain me with semicolons. A colonoscopy video will not show how to perform your own work for cheap. To tabulate the sheep I need to nap on the job, I plot my bleats on graph paper. This is another economy poem, I guess. Very sibilant, so we'll see how the microphone handles that. The title is stolen from a poker player named Amarillo Slim. The title of the poem is If You Don't See a Sucker. The full Amarillo Slim quote, he's talking about playing poker, and he says, when you sit down at a poker table, look around the table. If you don't see a sucker, stand back up, because you are the sucker. So the poem is If You Don't See a Sucker. If you see a secret mark on this ace, roll your assets over the dice to fall apart how far you guess. Lean your lease against the house. Scissors will always win unless paperless is sharper than slice. Choose to spin the cheese wheel twice for prices produce clerks produce. The boss of Lotto Loss can dismiss your suit or borrowed new blue dress. When they must repossess these geese, whose nest egg's just one grain of rice, Mr. Pigeon's on the case. And as I said, I came here a couple years ago from Colorado, so I have lots of Colorado poems. I've just started to write St. Louis and Missouri poems. I'm going to read one of those. It's sort of a, I'm not sure, satire or persona poem. I came here from Colorado Springs, which is, to put it nicely, a very white bread town and very homogenous. And then I live here. I live in South City, which is sort of the opposite. And it's really fascinating to me, coming from that background, to see these sort of class dynamics and ethnic dynamics and age dynamics and all sorts of things like that. So that this is just starting to begin to address things like that. It's called All Those Villains in Missouri. Oh, and the street reference at the beginning is actually my street that I live on, and some of the people who live there or in the area actually pronounce it the way it's stated in a second in the first line. So, All Those Villains in Missouri. Beethoven, our street's Beethoven. Those German noisemakers used enough rebar in their garage to prop up a Mississippi levee, not a Missouri Hoosier tooth. But when you take the kids to an orthodontist, look out, or he'll plant socialist medicine in their heads and metal transmitters to say, goodbye, Sammy Smile. Hi, Sammy Spy. That's what I said, bunny bread. Self-checkers in the ghetto schnooks only work for scabs who buy tall boys on Tattoos Day, or for certain welfarecans, you know the ones I mean. And And this one is another sort of in the same vein. I found that one thing I have a very hard time dealing with is the aging process into dementia. My grandmother right now is very far along into it. She doesn't know who I am anymore. She doesn't, for the most part, know who her own children are anymore. And I find that very difficult for me to deal with. I'm terrible about it. And so it kind of comes from there. Not all the stuff in this poem is based on my grandmother, though. It's based on various grandparents I know. And the title of this one is taken from an old Major League and Negro League baseball player named Satchel Paige, from something called His Rules for Growing Older. And his full quote is, one of his rules for growing older is, don't look back, something might be gaining on you. So the title of the poem is, Something Might Be Gaining on You. That's not my name, I told the neighbors when I fell, and they found me calling happy. That's my doxy mix, gone up 16 years this Sunday. Are you my son? If so, which one? No, I named my sons James and Jacob, and James, the oldest, who stole my mail except the bills, so we're not speaking. Though Dr. Blake made me promise to take those pills, I flushed them because he's a black. I looked back, but couldn't see the voice who whispered, hello, Crazy Lee. Anyway, that's not my name. This poem is sort of based on my relationship with my father, but I definitely, sort of, not truly, because I get along very well with my father, and despite what the last line may imply, my father's actually alive and healthy. So this is like, if my 17-year-old self had been able to write as well as I can write now, this is sort of what he might have written. It's called How Do You Like Your Blue-Eyed Boy, which is from E.E. Cummings. If invisible Mr. Lift and his amazing Bernoulli birds nosedived my father's balsa glider on the driveway, where did he bury the survivors? Do I believe in Dad despite the evidence? When I told him I feared the darkened yard, how long before garden gnomes started appearing in my bedroom overnight? Sketching on plywood sheets in the garage, did he build my character a rogue? At the end of days, exhausted, soft-tossing fastballs at my chest, did he lie for hours, too tired to trade me for a coordinated kid? Was I a pain until he pried me from his forehead with my body fully grown? Why am I inside Dad's shadow if it's already dead? And this is the last poem of the evening. It's another dysfunctional family poem. This one's about big dysfunctional family gatherings. I have a family that I used to think was very functional, but at our extended family gatherings recently, I've realized it's not the case at all. And actually, in some ways, I sort of like it that way. Some ways, yes. Some ways, no. The title is I've Had a Perfectly Wonderful Evening, which is from Groucho Marx. The full line is, I've had a perfectly wonderful evening, but this wasn't it. I've had a perfectly wonderful evening. If by evening you mean overflowing crock pot, if by perfectly wonderful you mean the same way a cage could be beautiful viewed from a skewed perspective, if by uncle you mean never trust a government that bugs your underwear with microscopic microphones, but another uncle is, how did the leper cannibal die? And one uncle is actually aunt. When you say gather, surely it's row the goat across the river, then return for the fox or the box of lettuce. Porch is short for ashtray. That old standby college stands for community college, and community is code for clown or maybe bartending. Take, I told you I'd bake a cake, as I'll be back in the car for an hour. The name Celeste is French for God damn. God equals party does not equal partay. If by house you mean wife, if by again you mean to death or next month. Thank you.